sure you can hear me.
No, why you're going to mic is over Gandhi or something.
No, this is good.
Sorry.
Our quiet and calm expectations speaks volumes. For the importance of this day, we call William Quan Judge Day, WQ Judge Day. It's important for us to remember that 121 years ago, he left us. Pardon, we changed that. He simply passed off the scene. He still lives. And what you will hear in the next few moments will prove this beyond the shadow of a doubt. He was born in Dublin, Ireland, April 4th, 1851. His father's name, Frederick, his mother, Mary Alice Quan. There were seven children. She passed away, giving birth to her seventh child. It should be taken into notice that when William was 7 years old, very sick, and the physicians, after examining him, pronounced him dead. Fortunately, someone saw his chest heave, proving that he was still breathing. He was never the same after that. For a child that young, he began to take interest in things such as magic. His literature that he was interested in was far beyond those literatures that 7 years old or a child would use. We only mention it so that you could take note of the fact. When he's 13 years old, the family left and came here to America, to New York. We'll be brief about that, because during that time, being in America, the opportunities for immigrants to become United States citizens was great. As he progressed in age, he attended school in New York City, became a lawyer, and passed the bar. Take note. He married shortly after that, but his wife passed away during childbirth. We should take note about William when he was very young. There's an anecdote that everyone hears. It seems that as a young boy, he was with his friends one day, and they decided to swim across a creek, a pretty wide creek. He couldn't swim. So when his friends were on the other side, they began to jibe him, kid him. Come on. But Williams walked into the water, sunk below the surface, and that scared him to death. His head soon popped up above the water, but he was only a quarter away across. But the next three or four sinkings and risings, he finally reached the other side. We mention it as an example of determination. There are lots of other stories we could tell about him, but we don't have all that time. We know that he married here, and their child died in birth. This is an important fact that we should remember, that immigrants often suffered from poor health, etc., here in this country at first. He happened to be interested in such things as magic, religion, philosophy, and spiritualism at that time. So he knew how to contact Alcott. Everybody's heard of Alcott, who was a friend of HPB. And of course, he, Alcott, introduced them shortly after that. It is stated, and he noted, that when their eyes met, they both knew that it was not the first time they had ever met. That's important to remember. Next important date, 1875, because John, Williams' brother, and several others helped HEPB get ISIS unveiled out to the public. And at the same time, please note, about that time, 1875 and 6, the Theosophical Society began to take shape. There's a lot more that we could tell you about William Quan Judge that would surprise you. These events are of a cosmic nature. The next few readings and the talk we will have will prove it to you beyond a shadow of a doubt. In 1875, 6, 7, 8, 9, in South America, malaria, Chagres fever, intestinal worms, all sorts of things were taking people's lives. Don't forget, shortly after that, or during that time, they were planning the Panama Canal, too. That was 1876. In 1896, at the age of 45 years, William Quan Judge, friend, teacher, philosopher, passed away. He died. But that's just a figure of speech, because we know he still lives. Now, there will be a short period, and you will hear four readings from those things that prove that he still lived: the Ocean of Theosophy, the Bhagavad Gita, the Epitome, Letters That Have Helped Me, just to name a few. After these four readings have been completed, there will be a short talk in memory of William Quan Judge, friend, philosopher, teacher. Thank you very much.
Our duty is to keep alive in man his spiritual intuitions, to oppose and counteract, after due investigation and proof of its irrational nature. That doesn't sound right, but that's what it says. Bigotry in every form, religious, scientific, or social, and cant above all, whether as religious sectarianism, or as belief in miracles, or anything supernatural. What we believe, what we have to do is seek to obtain knowledge of all the laws of nature to diffuse it. The courage, encourage the nature of those laws least understood by modern people, the so-called entire occult sciences, based on the natural knowledge of nature, instead of, at the present, on superstitious beliefs based on faith or blind faith and authority. Be this as it may, a religion of the ancients is the religion of the future. A few centuries more and there will linger no more sectarian beliefs, no sectarian beliefs in either the religion of humanity, Brahmanism, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, will all disappear before the mighty rush of facts. The esoteric philosophy is alone considered calculated withstand in this age of crass and illogical materialism. The repeated attacks on all man holds most dear and sacred in his spiritual life. Esoteric philosophy reconciles all religions, strips everyone of its outward human garments, and shows the root of each to be identical with that of every other religion. It proves the necessity of an absolute divine principle in nature. It denies deity no more than it does the sun. It is well known that the first main objective from which the theosophical movement was founded was to bring about the actualization of universal brotherhood without distinction of race, creed, condition, color, caste, or race, gender. This can only be achieved by recognizing that universal brotherhood is not merely a noble and lofty ideal, but it is actually an eternal fact in nature, due to the oneness and divineness of all life. It is already the case that we are one in terms of our source and origin, our inner spiritual essence, and our ultimate destiny. But this needs to be recognized, accepted, and acted upon.
from the writings of W.Q. Judge. To many who think themselves theosophically alone in their own town, have folded their hands and shut up their minds, saying to themselves that they could do nothing, that no one was near who could possibly care for theosophy, and that that particular town was the most difficult for the work. The great mistakes in these cases is forgetting the law indicated in what HPB wrote. It is one that every member ought to know, that the mind of man is capable of bringing about results through means of other minds about him. If we sit and think that nothing can be done, then our subtle mind meets other minds within the radius of our sphere, not small, and shouts into them, nothing can be done. Of course, then, nothing is done. But if unselfishly and earnestly we think theosophy and desire that others should, like us, be benefited by it, then to the minds we meet in the many stray moments of the day and in the many hours of the night, we cry, theosophy, and help and hope for thee. So masters have said, this is a transition age, and he who has ears to hear will hear what has thus been said. We are working for the new cycle and centuries. What we do now in this transition age will be like what the great Dion Shohans did in the transition point, the midway point in evolution, at the time when all matter and all types were in transition and fluid state. Then they gave the new impulse for the new types, which resulted later in all the vast varieties of nature. In mental development, we are now at the same point. And what we now do in faith and hope for others and for ourselves will result similarly on the plane to which it is all directed. Thus, in other centuries, we will come out again and go on with it. If we neglect it now, so much the worse for us. Hence, we are not working for some definite organization of the new years to come, but for a change in the manners and booty of the race. That is why it may seem indefinite, but it is nevertheless very defined and very great in scope.
From the writings of Robert Crosby. The great message of theosophy has provided for every interested inquirer the means by which he may know the truth about himself and nature. But can you give to anyone what he does not want? There has to be an open mind, a pure heart, an eager intellect, an unveiled spiritual perception before there is any hope for us. This great message is for the hungry, for the weary, for those who are desirous of knowledge, for those who see the absolute paucity of what has been put before us as knowledge by those who style themselves our teachers. for those who find no explanation anywhere of the mysteries that surround us, who do not know themselves, who do not understand themselves. For them, this whole movement is kept in being by one single will, the will of the elder brothers who have carried these great eternal truths through good and evil in order that mankind may be benefited. Not desiring any reward, not desiring any recognition, desiring only that their fellow men, their younger brothers, may know, may realize what they know. Either theosophy pure and undefiled is the most real thing in the world, or we are all wasting our time and effort. If we are able to conceive its reality in all seriousness, we should then never cease trying to understand and apply what has been recorded by Master's messenger for our guidance and instruction. What is the distinction between theosophy and anything else? In fundamental principles, I should say. Nothing else affords all-inclusive view of existence. All kinds of sincere efforts help. All kinds of systems contain some truth, but they all fall short because they all exclude or ignore some part of nature. If this is a movement inspired by masters, it is for us and for all others who would serve them to apply their teachings. There is no time limit to effort.
From the writings of W.Q. Judge. All of us are brought to this study by our own request made to our higher self, who is Krishna. It does not matter whether he now is consciously aware of having made the request, nor whether it was made as a specific act in this life or in many other precedent one. It was made and it is to be answered at the right time. Some of us have asked this many times before. It is more than likely in the case of those who are spurred on to intense effort and longing to know the truth and to strive for unity with God that they have put up the petition ages since. All the passing shows of life, whether fraught with disaster or full of fame and glory, are teachers. He who neglects them neglects opportunities that seldom the gods repeat. And the only way to learn from them is through the heart's resignation. For when we become in heart completely poor, we are at once are the treasures and dispersers of enormous riches. The attitude to be assumed then is that of doing every act, small and great, trifling or important, because it is before us to do, and as a mere carrying out by us as instruments of the will of that deity who is ourself. This practice is the highest that we that which someday we must and will learn to perform. It must follow that the humblest imitator, everyone who desires to come to that condition, must try to the best of his ability to imitate the sage who has succeeded. And such is the word of the Master. For he says in many places that if we expect to have his help, we must apply ourselves to the work of helping humanity to the extent of our ability. No more than this is demanded. Krishna says that those who with the eye of spiritual wisdom see that the self is all begin to reincarnate with that belief ingrained in them, and at last they become what was mentioned in the opening verses, a Mahatma or great soul.
Actually, we have so far heard a great deal that would inspire us. And we would ask, because we do record our meetings, that you turn off your cell phones and don't text. And just to mention, you can go into our website and hear the pods, is that what they're called, of our Sunday meetings.
Podcast,
thank you. Our meeting relates to, as you heard, William Kwan Judge, a theosophist of the, not the last century, the one before. All around the world at this very moment, there are students of theosophy commemorating the life and works of this great soul. And if you were not familiar with the original writings of theosophy, you might think this is just sort of some cycle of necessity where you're going to say things, flattering things about someone you didn't even know. But it isn't a necessity. It is a coming together of souls, any soul who has ever tasted or touched the work of William Kwan Judge. We do know Mr. Judge because he knows us. The real commemoration for such a being takes place in the heart and mind of someone who is grateful. And why are we grateful? Because of what he did, what he taught us about the philosophy, of course, but more about ourselves, what it means to be a student. And this commemoration is in line with what he would have done to point out and give credit where credit is due. The irony of this is he would not want us to do it for himself. He would instead be saying, well, get on with the work, not the pointing out of me. There's a double irony in this because it is the behavior of Mr. Judge alone that makes it impossible to quickly or easily recognize his wisdom and his power. Not only did he write in such a simple way, which is deceptive until you try to explain theosophy to somebody else, and then you realize the most difficult explanation is making it the most simple, and yet he did it over and over again. But he also made it difficult for us in that he did not want anyone to assume that anything he wrote or said was gospel, because he was one of the original founders. So he went out of his way to use pseudonyms. Here's just a few of them. We're not sure we can even say these all correctly. Eusebio Urban, Rodriguez Undiano, Haji Erin, William Brehan, Quilliam, Martanda, Brian Kinnivan, Zadok, an obscure Brahmin, an American mystic, Mulvey, Alpha, ex-Asiatic, occultist, Ramatirtha. At the same time, when others were putting forth all their wisdom and knowledge and pointing to themselves as the knower of it, he was putting forth the wisdom and knowledge of the elder brothers, the adepts, and pointing to them, never to himself. Put this together with the fact that William Quan Judge never wrote a book. We have things out on the book table, and we would ask you to look on your way out, with his name on it, but they aren't books that he wrote. In the case of Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms and the Bhagavad Gita, they were translations he made of the original. The other things that you see with his name on it were lectures and letters that others brought together and printed under his name. And it's true, he wrote them, but he didn't write them as a book. So someone might say, well, what about The Ocean of Theosophy? That's a book that Mr. Judge wrote. No. It's a series of newspaper articles that someone decided it would be a good idea for everyone to have this material. And in studying that material, anyone who has read The Secret Doctrine realizes that that small book is a summary of all of the important points and important subjects in Theosophy. In spite of the fact that he was sympathetic, wise, friendly, he was also knowable. We never have to wonder, what did he mean by that? He's clear, he's direct, and sometimes to the point where it's almost painful. You feel like he has seen into your heart and your mind very clearly. But at the same time, he's a very gentle physician, offering the remedy for what ails you, if you're willing to take it. Our title, William Quan Judge, philosopher, guide, friend. Well, what is a philosopher? A philosopher is one who sets out certain principles and then himself lives by those principles, acts on those principles. Well, one of the things that we can know in looking at the history of the treatment of Mr. Judge, he was very harshly treated. He never responded in kind. Indeed, one of the most wonderful statements we think that he ever made was when a woman came and asked him, "What are the inner psychic powers that I should develop?" And he answered, "Cast no one out of your heart." That's it. That's all the psychic power you need. For if you have that, according to Theosophy, an open heart, a sense of non-separateness, of universal brotherhood, all the other powers will naturally arise within you from the position that you have taken. It is a question of time and wisdom, and not an effort to gain any powers. The power we want is compassion. The power we need is understanding. If you want a guide, you want someone who has been where you wish to go. But the use or the effort or the appreciation of a guide is not the map and the instructions that they will give us, because that's not the journey. We have to take the map and the instructions and make the journey, and then we realize the value of a guide, because it's within that journey we reach back and question what we're struggling with. Mr. Judge was a brilliant guide in showing us that the very word disciple comes from discipline, and it is self-discipline that we require to begin to act for and as the good of all, and not ourselves, for we're not personal separate beings to begin with. That's the workbook or the illusion we're working through and with. And with a friend like Mr. Judge, if we really rely upon that wisdom, we're in a safe place. It was HPB who called him her only friend. And she pointed to the fact that his magazine, aptly named for a guide, The Path, his magazine was the true spiritual link between what was mentioned earlier, Buddhi Manas, the spiritual intellection and the higher mind, that magazine made the link between the East and the West, between the spirit and the soul, or the struggling soul seeking understanding. Is he our friend? To the extent that we allow it to be so. If HPB gave us the who, what, when, why, he gave us the how. How do we apply what theosophy holds out to us? How do we take these overreaching, huge, universal principles and reflect them in our own individual heart and mind, in our own life as we're living it? One of the perhaps mistakes we all make is in our enthusiasm, we start to act as though we have already understood and are in possession of certain principles. And then when we fall on our face, and we will, which is nature's blessing, when we fall on our face, we don't understand what went wrong. And that's when we have to go backwards, look at our motive, look at our behavior, and find in the writings and works of Mr. Judge the very remedy that we do need. For that's what his works come down to for us. The best kind of soul medicine. He tells us directly. And we have put together a compendium. It's on the book table that's to be put by the usher's table so that you can pick it up. It's just some samples of statements made by Mr. Judge that help us to understand what to do. The amazing thing about these statements is they're only taken randomly from pages 1 to 15 from Letters That Have Helped Me, which is a 300-page book. So imagine how many more treasures are there which you have to go after. And we hope you do peruse his writings and make note for yourself the remedies that are there for you, because we're all just a little bit different. Think about it. What is an audience but eyes all at the same place but sitting in a different place of seeing? We are all in a different place, and it's what we have created life after life, although what we're seeing at the moment is only a sampling for ourselves. It's the tip of the iceberg, and life, if we allow it to happen, will show us where we have serious flaws buried within that iceberg, things that need to be fixed and repaired before we can be trusted with greater wisdom, greater understanding. Because think about it, just as thinkers, we're already pretty dangerous as we are. Imagine if we had greater power. So Mr. Judge makes us humble and proud at the same time. Humble because we're just a part of one great whole. We're no different from the Buddha, except the Buddha knows who and what he is. We are the same, but we don't know it, and therefore we can't act on it. So we can't be humble because of that, and yet we can't be proud, because it's true of everyone else as well. So, we heard that he married and had a child, and it is that death of that child that caused him to seek out answers and brought him to the feet of H.P. Blavatsky. And as was mentioned, at the moment they laid eyes on each other, they both recognized that they had been working together over many lives. But how he managed to stay in the proper position of student disciple when everyone else was seeking and posing to greater wisdom, and he, who was always showing his wisdom, absolutely remained true and loyal to Blavatsky, the masters, and the original writings. Reading the history of the movement is a fascinating thing. And we would recommend, if you have the time, reading in letters that have helped me about his life and about some mysterious ideas. We'll just mention it briefly, but it's really quite fascinating. In letters, he has a recommendation for a novel, and he calls it In a Borrowed Body. And he goes on to describe this. Well, if you take it backwards to Mr. Judge as a 7-year-old child who was pronounced dead, and in the sudden coming back to life was found to be able to read and write. Well, he couldn't read and write before he was declared dead. He had no interest in the things he was interested in after this recovery. Revelations in the Bible, Rosicrucianism, occultism, various aspects of religion and mystery. It's a very interesting idea, and when you read In a Borrowed Body, you read that this young Raja had an experience of a, whether you call it a wizard, an adept, showing up and saying, you made a promise a long time ago, are you willing to keep it? And the young Raja said, yes. And the next thing he knew, he was standing over a dying child. And the adept said, this is the body you will enter. And the novel goes on to say that in the beginning, the Raja was a Raja in India and then would go to bed and then would be a little boy in Ireland. And the strain on his mind and heart was so great that they wiped the memory of it from him, and he stayed in the Irish mind. Now, whether you accept that or not, it's certainly a fascinating idea, and it does explain many things about Mr. Judge and many little cryptic sort of messages he left. Like when he apologized to somebody and was trying to explain that it's very difficult for him to control this Irish nature. And therefore, we don't mean there's anything wrong with being Irish, but it's that he could not control certain things that were antagonistic to this other person, and he was apologizing for it. There are other cryptic statements he made that make you think, you know, I trust this man. Literally, I trust this man with my life, because there are times when he says something that I have experienced, and I know he's been as low as I am right now, and yet he shows me how to reverse that. Therefore, I trust him. Well, he wouldn't be making fun of me by making me think he might be this Raja living in an Irish body. It's all very mysterious, but you have fun with that mystery for yourself. And read, Judge, and we think it's only fair to say, if you are a real student, he is your best friend, doctor, philosopher, guide, and friend. We want to read you, and you will find this also in letters, and you might want to read the entire part. August Lindstrom had never seen Judge in life, and he, a sculptor, was asked to make a cast of Judge's head, or a death mask. And Lindstrom wrote the following: "While making the death mask, I was struck by the shape of Mr. Judge's head, which was utterly unlike anything I had ever seen." Now, just for the interesting part of it, you can go into our library and you will see there is a marble bust of Mr. Judge. "Most of the heads of remarkable men show the development of one faculty in particular, or perhaps of several, and to the neglect of other faculties. I saw at once that Mr. Judge's head evidenced a high and uniform development of all the faculties, well balanced throughout. This is the remarkable combination I found: a tremendous willpower with an equal development of gentleness, thorough practicability and adaptability conjoined to a highly idealistic nature, and a gigantic intellect hand in hand with selflessness and modesty. There are only two heads that I know of in history that compare with his: Michelangelo's and Savonarola's. The back of Michelangelo's head is almost identical with the back of Mr. Judge's. Taken altogether, there was harmonious development with no defects present, and careful examination of his head from every aspect proves that he was a great and noble man. If such a man as he would devote his life to the Theosophical Society, I think it must have a great mission, and I shall ask to be admitted as a member." And that is a beautiful testimony, but it's a testimony that any one of us could make. We never laid eyes on him, back of head or front of head, except, of course, we have wonderful pictures of him. But we have a picture of him that is much more complete than that. We have registered his heart and mind, and it registers within us. And we are told a wonderful, wonderful thing, that as we study more and more his words, we enter spiritually into his mind. Now that is a beautiful thought, to know that as humble as we are, we have the right to approach such a soul because of our devotion to what he was devoted to, which was the elevation of humanity, the realization that we are spiritual beings and that we have to work together. Now, we would ask you to stay for the fellowship of this moment. Share your thoughts and ideas. Go look at the bust of Judge in the library. Look at the book table and realize this man never wrote a book, although the book table is loaded with books by Judge. That's not what he did. What he did was share what he could with all of us, and we'll never stop being grateful. Meeting is adjourned.